People sometimes speak of nonviolence, which is not a word I like. It's too vague, sloppy, etc., etc. Nonviolence, and then there's armed struggle. And of course, everybody knows armed struggle is more effective because you've got something to fight with. And you've got nonviolence, you've got the absence of something. I say nonviolent struggle is armed struggle. And we have to take back that term from those advocates of violence who try to justify with pretty words that kind of combat. Only with this type of struggle, one fights with psychological weapons, social weapons, economic weapons, and political weapons. And that this is ultimately more powerful against oppression, injustice, and tyranny than is violence.
We don't care anymore about sound quality. Sound quality can go to hell. What are we doing today, guys? I forgot.
Non-violence.
The lie of non-violence.
Scam of non-violence.
The non-violence scam. The scam of non-violence. It's a scam.
Okay, I'm taking charge.
Who are you?
Well, we're not rambling, you know? We're not going to just do this like rambling world tour.
Yeah. No, you take charge and then you ask us questions. And then we answer and then you go back to your presentation.
My name is Justin Podur and I'm here to discuss nonviolence with the panelists Sina Rahmani and Ziad
Al-Nabulsi. You can't do this. This is terrible.
No,
you can't do this. You sound like...
It's terrible.
Like,
but you know, I did
Orphan... Orson Welles.
You always go back to the 50s. That's what happens.
The 40s.
When you say...
than the 40s.
You want formal,
it should have been.
formal structure. Okay, no, but seriously. Nonviolence. And I wanted to start with the philosophical, and Ziad is kind of a philosophical person.
Who's Ziad?
I'll introduce myself. I'm Ziad. Most of my research is on modern African intellectual history, including African philosophy and history of science. Should I talk about nonviolence?
Yeah, it was your idea to discuss nonviolence.
Fair enough. So I think in terms of the philosophical angle, so here is one way to explain why nonviolence is perhaps, you know, prevalent as a kind of trope that gets invoked in a lot of contemporary political discourse and a lot of contemporary moral discourse. So think of like somebody like who's a Kantian or something, so follows like Immanuel Kant. If you look at a certain approach to moral philosophy, it's saying, okay, look, the world is a horrible place, basically, and I want to get out of this world with my hands as clean as possible. I think that's more or less an accurate gloss of like what a Kantian would think. Once you have that point of view, I think, then it becomes about fetishizing things like nonviolence, and it becomes sort of a normative debate about, you know, what is sort of right and wrong from a moral standpoint. And it's not that these debates are not important, but I think when we're talking about politics, and here I think we'll try to pivot, we're talking about what is also efficacious, because there is sometimes the way people talk about this, they say something like violence never works. Which will show, you know, like through this episode, that this is just as a descriptive claim, it is utterly false. So that's where I think we should focus. That's my view.
Okay, so normative, you mean in terms of how one should be?
Yes, precisely.
So
precisely.
If you want to make the world a better place, you shouldn't do violence. That kind of idea, because violence hurts the person you're doing
violence to. And it hurts you, so some people say, you know, dehumanize.
Yeah. So, is that true? Or are you saying we're not even going to talk about that today?
I mean, we can talk about it, but I think here is the problem. I think the normative or moral standpoint, I think becomes very inadequate for actually understanding concrete political issues. Because then we talk about like general principles, and then we try, okay, let's have a debate about general principles. Under what conditions is violence acceptable? We don't actually discuss any concrete case studies. And then we'll talk about some concrete case studies today. So Palestine, I think, will be one of our centered case studies. So, I mean, yeah, my inclination is to say, like, ignore, like, what should I do question and think about, okay, you know, how do these organizations work? What is efficacious? I know that sounds sort of Machiavellian, and it is sort of, but I think that's also like an element of Marxism, is to like reject this moralistic normative discourse.
Well,
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for moralistic discourse. I am. I think it's a great thing to do to figure out how to be a good person and what to do to be a good person in the world. But that becomes, when you start adding, you can have that abstract, you know, you can build that abstract kind of house out of a series of premises. But when you get into a concrete political situation, then you have many, many, many more variables. Mm-hmm. And then to say that if someone is trying to kill you, if someone is doing Machiavellian cold-blooded politics against you, for you to say, I'm not going to do that in return, could be immoral.
Mm-hmm.
You could be enabling something worse.
Mm-hmm.
So there are norms that work in simple situations or laboratory situations that don't translate to the real world. So maybe that's reason enough to reject starting from a normative perspective. I don't know. Like, what kind of good, maybe are nonviolent people better people?
This is bullshit. This is all bullshit. Like, this entire, like, the idea, like, the world is this infinitely diverse place,
yeah,
full of thousands of years of civilizational violence and terror. Like, that isn't, I mean, like, that's, I mean, that's simplifying it. The idea that you can break off history at a nice fictional point and say, oh, from now on, we do no violence. And that's as if,
yeah,
and then on top of that, there's all these, which is so stupid, which is just,
yeah,
like a stupid,
yeah,
liberal idea that ultimately says more about the discourse itself and the people who are trapped in it, i.e. all of us. Because once again, we have to realize that, like, we talk about politics. We actually live in extremely depoliticized societies, all of us, like, especially in the English-speaking world, at least, whereby corporate media and the cultural wars that are curated by corporate media in alliance with academia and whatever curate a set of talking points for every semester, like some fashion house, you know, like that. Like, it's, you know, and it's not to suggest that there's, you know, like, this is all pre-prepared or whatever. Like, I'm not a tinfoil hat guy, but in the sense that there's a very small agenda of what gets discussed, and it's all done within this tiny bandwidth or a narrow spectrum of this option. And then we're back to the original problem of electoralism. So all of this entire discourse is itself false, because what we're doing is just doing political theory. So that's the thing. And the political theory of, well, what is good and what is bad, which is totally stupid. And especially when it comes to the question of violence, which is, it fundamentally also makes a definition of violence of the guy with a Kalashnikov and a keffiyeh carrying a urban gorilla, like, as if that's the only form of political violence, as if there isn't political violence unfolding every day in late capitalist society everywhere. And it's classed, and it's raced, and it's gendered, and it's got all kinds of complications and nuances based on the social context. And so the very idea that we can speak in theoretical terms, global theoretical terms, about this stupid fake thing called nonviolence, it's one of the sort of weird things that we absorbed as radicalism, which is sold to us as radicalism. So, like, WTO protests and all that stuff that the Gen X kids did, namely you, and then the lingering years of that.
Yeah.
But anyways, like, yeah, that's so, my contention, is that this is conversation itself is false.
That's,
but we should,
yeah,
read this article. Though.
That's
like, yeah,
the conclusion. The conclusion, to skip ahead to the conclusion of this whole discussion, from my perspective, is that the entire dichotomy is fake. The debate is fake. Dichotomy is fake. There's no meaningful way to debate violence versus nonviolence,
yeah,
in politics.
It's all a big red herring conversation.
There's violence.
Yeah.
There's nonviolence. Both are always present.
Yeah.
To divide it artificially into one and the other. It's like, I don't know, I can't think of a great analogy. I've been thinking about analogies, and I think it's like, imagine dividing fighting into punches with your right hand and punches with your left hand, and saying punches with your left hand are off limits, but punches with your right hand are fine. You create this taboo when there's no meaningful difference between those two things.
And can I just add something with that analogy? It's, you know, you're banning, you know, using your left hand only on one side, so it's asymmetric.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
very important, because your opponent,
right,
doesn't care. You know, like, they're,
mm-hmm,
like, okay, you're an idiot, then I'm going to take advantage of,
yeah,
it. Thank you. You know,
it's also like it's a symptom of the fact that our depoliticized era, and like under neoliberalism, is trapped under this stupid, like, memorial rubble, like cultural memory rubble of World War II, the defeat of the Nazis as some kind of, and the rise of American Pax Americana, whatever, as some kind of epoch in human history, which in reality is has a half-truth in the sense that for the last 30 years, we've lived in the monopolar American world. And that's something we should think about. And like this thing that we're going to talk about today, nonviolence and the institutionalization of it through activists and through the work of Gene Sharp, specifically, the presentation of the the Third Reich as the antithesis to liberalism itself, with its weird diabolical cousin communism, right? And these are two wings of authoritarian politics that were thorough-handedly defeated by liberalism in 1991, such that their mediocre neocon philosophers were announcing the end of history. I mean, come on.
Let's go back. Let's take it back to Domenico Lacerdo's book about nonviolence. Okay, Lacerdo, philosopher, I think.
Yeah.
But great history. He wrote The Counter History of Liberalism, which I would highly recommend to everybody. And then he has this book about nonviolence, and a lot of it's got Gandhi, but the chronological thing that he starts with is the so-called non-resistors. So there were these abolitionists, white abolitionists, Christian religious people who were against slavery in the mid 19th century, you know, so from 1808 when Britain stopped the slave trade, they were pushing for abolition in America. And these people were very, very specific that they did not support any slaves uprising. Okay, so they were very careful. They broadcast that from everywhere. They were like, we don't want slaves to take up arms. We don't want slaves to rise up. Slaves should suffer and show by their suffering that they're human beings, whatever, Christians, etc. And Lacerdo talks about what happened in the 1840s, there were these thousands of riots, most of them against abolitionists, lots of them to do with politics and elections and stuff. And some of these white abolitionists were lynched. They were killed by pro-slavery people. And he kind of tracks some of these non-resistance people and the changes in their views as more and more of them are getting killed by pro-slavery. And they gradually start at least supporting some kind of defensive violence, at least for themselves. They may not support a slave revolt, but they start saying, well, these people are, you know, we're against violence against human beings, but these are not human beings, I say. You know, William Lloyd Garrison being the biggest example of this. But of course, there were black abolitionists, like the people described in a book called Force and Freedom, who were always about armed abolition, and then of course John Brown kind of put an end to the debate. It's like, yeah, we're not going to have this nonviolence debate anymore. And you know, so that kind of was the closing of that chapter of nonviolence. But then
they had an entire war about slavery.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how much nonviolence means to the United States. Yeah. They had a full-scale war the entirety of their country.
But, Brown wanted to start that war sooner, right? Yeah. Brown was like, we need to get this war going. And a lot of his abolitionist Christian comrades were like, no, we can't have slaves, doing violence. That would be violence, right? And Brown just wasn't having it. So, like I said, he didn't win that debate in the debating society. But he didn't. So the next time we pick up the nonviolence thread in terms of global movements is Gandhi. And Lacerdo talks about how Gandhi organized medical brigades to fight for the British in World War I. And his whole thing was like, we don't have to shoot or kill people, but we can show how courageous we are on the battlefield, and by showing that we are real men, we can convince the British to let us free, give us freedom. So it was kind of like Lacerdo says that it's more about co-optation than resistance. Than nonviolent resistance. So, like, there's a whole discussion worth having about what the difference is, right? So it's like, now we're into modes of resistance. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about resistance, we're talking about trying to fight back. And, you know, you have Gandhi, you have Martin Luther King a little bit later. And these people are talking about fighting back. So how about the efficacy of nonviolent resistance? Is that a topic? Do you want to?
Yeah. I think the point about efficacy and is important because it emphasizes, you know, we can't really discuss efficacy without talking about context. So global context is one factor. You know, it's not so. For example, in evaluating the success or failures of Gandhi and the movement for independence in India, you have to, you know, look at the global context. You have to look at like the internal balance of power. You have to look at all of these considerations. But people just want to talk abstractly about, oh, nonviolence works or something. You know, maybe under some circumstances it does. Other circumstances it simply doesn't. I'll give an example where it didn't in the 50s as well. So. The PAIGC and the party which liberated Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde eventually from Portuguese rule. At first, they tried having like peaceful, you know, worker strikes and so on. And I think so 1959, there was this massive massacre. Basically, just the Portuguese just shot like the protesters. And after that, you see, okay, they turned towards, you know, a people's guerrilla war because it's clear in this context that, you know, the Portuguese will not give up without a struggle. And there is, again, a kind of political economy explanation for that because Portugal was so weak as an economic power, it couldn't have a neo-colonial relationship with its African colonies. It's not like France, not like Britain. And it's true. So after the Portuguese left, you know, they were not the main neo-colonial power, you know, in either Guinea-Bissau or Cape Verde or even Angola. Yeah. So that context is really important. And that's why I think the history itself is very important as well. Beyond just like the normative philosophical debates about, oh, is nonviolence good or bad? I mean, it's not that I think those debates are totally irrelevant, but I think they've been given an outsized importance.
They are irrelevant.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was trying to be diplomatic.
Well, it is irrelevant. It has no, like, it fundamentally, like, the way that we get to the point of history that we're in right now, where we're even having these absurd debates about violence and nonviolence. In 2021, the idea that you can confront some of the most powerful police institutions, instruments of state violence, most advanced in the world, are deployed in any population. And I guess this is perpetually true of the last 200 years because policing technology is basically that old. Like modern police is 2 centuries old, the way we understand it. And it's evolved.
Ireland,
and it's colonial in context, of course, like everything. And then part of it developed in the colonial setting. But anyways, I mean, the very fact that we can even be at this point where the egghead class, the tiny, irrelevant, let's underscore this again, the tiny, irrelevant class of eggheads and liberals and writers and journalists and all of their hangers-on, the tiny class of them circulate position papers around this abstract topic as if it means anything to anyone in any position, right? Like this thing is a reflection of the poverty of our discourse. And this is something that I keep returning to, that it's so depoliticized that our understanding of politics is so juvenile that we could even entertain this logic that, oh, if you just protest enough, the state will change its mind. Because that's how democracy works. And it's grow up, people.
So we have,
this is not how states work.
We have Gandhi. And Gandhi's got a really interesting history because he joins the Congress when the Congress is really like a loyal opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Talk shop. So they're just talking.
Right.
They're like, please, they're signing petitions. They're writing letters. And, you know, it really is a co-optation machine. And Gandhi gets them into, you know, so-called organizing, mobilization, mass mobilizations. He involves millions of people. And so that's a whole other level above what they were doing.
Right.
But there were, like, the history of that movement over the decades that Gandhi was involved. And I have yet to study this properly. I have been trying to find sources. It's hard to find sources. But there was lots of terrorism. There was lots of bomb throwing. There was lots of violence. I mean, you know, like we talked about 1857 before, but I mean, I'm trying to sort out what was going on prior to Indian independence in the decades before. And we know there were, you know, there was the famous case of Bhagat Singh who threw a bomb and was hanged. There were lots of people who were hanged. There was, of course, during World War II, there was the Indian National Army of Subhash Bose, who was trained by the Japanese. And didn't do very well, but it was a kind of a sign to the British that, you know, he was able to recruit and organize an actual military invasion of India. Again, not super successful. And then there was apparently another mutiny in like 1943 of sailors in India. So the writing on the wall in terms of violence was also going on. And there's also critiques of Gandhi by people like Ambedkar, who was one of the leaders of the Untouchables, who was saying, like, you know, Gandhi would go on a fast to try to coerce Untouchables not to seek certain affirmative action type provisions in the law. And Ambedkar had this thing where he was like, that's great, Gandhi. That's so great that you've chosen this non-coercive method of, you know, nonviolent coercion against me and the Untouchable community. So what happens if you finish your fast and die of hunger on your hunger strike? Do you think that all of your gentle, kind supporters will not be enacting reprisals against the Untouchable community? Because I sure think they will. I sure think this non-coercion threat is actually a massive gun pointed at the head of our community if you die. So it's also this kind of abstraction. On the Martin Luther King front, there's like, you know, Negroes with Guns. There's a book called Negroes with Guns. There's a book called We Will Shoot Back. There's another one called This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, I think it's called. But they talk about how many of these Martin Luther King followers were actually armed and walked around armed because they're like, are you crazy? Of course I'm armed. You know, so for them, nonviolence was not like, a way of life or whatever. It was a very specific tactic.
It's a tactical choice.
Fear of life.
Yeah.
So,
and it's also context specific. Like, this is also the symptom. Again, the poverty of our discourse, of our political imagination, is so profound that we're incapable. Like, and we know so little about. Collectively, as cultures, we know so little about the outside world that we can't possibly ever imagine that we could go so far and tell things to other people that, oh, this kind of politics is bad, this kind of politics is good. But of course, what we are doing is reacting to the media we consume, right? Which is itself ridiculous understanding of the world politics. No, you're not talking about world politics. You're talking about the thing you saw on the nightly news broadcast. Now, the internet has changed that somewhat, has altered the representation, but only until 20, 15 years ago were we able to even get non-corporate like information, like easily, reliably, without having to, like, you know, pay $12 a month and get it by mail, you know, on this antique, basically 18th century like infrastructure of like print. But like, that's only recently, and even until then the response is just to, like, you know, have monopoly control over these media companies. They can do whatever. We all know the story.
It goes back before that.
It's so fraudulent.
So liberals in the States, these non-resistors, were saying it's wrong to do violence to try to change slavery. But it's like, they're not counting the lashes, right? Like, every lash, you would think that every lash that takes place in the field to get somebody to speed up their cotton harvesting, you would think that would be considered violence. Because if someone's lashing a white person, that sure as hell counts as violence.
Right.
What, you know, daily violence. Does daily violence...
Right, does it count?
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading this book. It's sort of like an oral history of Nasserism in Arabic. And I really recommend it. It's by Khalid Abu Layl. It's in Arabic, though. I think it's called, like, Tariq al-Shaabi lil-Hikba al-Nasriya. And he talks about you know, these villages in Upper Egypt, so Southern Egypt, were, you know, up until like the 50s. So if you're like a regular peasant or something, you know, you're walking across and you see like a lamda or like one of sort of the notables of the town, you have to dismount, you bow down. That's a form of violence, you know.
Yeah.
That's like,
yeah, well, I mean, it's because, violence, because
yeah,
what if you don't do that?
Yeah.
What happens to you if you don't do that?
And like, imagine you're a dad with your kids and then you have to like grovel in front of this guy.
Yeah.
Just like on a daily basis, you know. It's not an event really, just like it's a lifestyle sort of thing. And but this violence is rendered invisible, you know.
Okay, so when you first brought up the idea of doing an episode on nonviolence, I immediately thought of this two-part article by Marcy Smith on the nonsite.org, and it's about Jean Sharp. And Jean Sharp is what Marcy Smith describes as a defense intellectual. He worked at Harvard his whole life, starting in the 50s. And there's a whole ideology, a really well-developed ideology, from the 1950s on, that Gene Sharp takes up. It's called he calls his institute the Albert Einstein Institute. Mm-hmm. He gets some kind of early endorsement from Einstein, and he takes up these symbols, Gandhi, whatever, Martin Luther King, these different nonviolent icons, but he develops a whole system. And the system is for, you know, the contradiction, the ideological system is the contradiction in the world is between violence and nonviolence. Violence is when you impose your will on someone else, when you do harm to impose your will on someone else. And out in the world, the people that are doing this the most are states, regardless of their political orientation. States are doing violence to people every day. And the way to combat this violence is by overthrowing these states,
yeah,
in a nonviolent way, through non-revolutionary nonviolence, is what, you know, Marcy Smith quotes.
For over 10 years, when all our sophisticated correspondents and editors, with exceptions, the New York Times reporter was here the other day, said, well, solidarity's dead. We know that. Even one famous peace researcher pronounced that. There's nothing weak about a technique of struggle which can take the legitimacy away from an repressive government, which can produce a defiant population uncontrollable by the police and military forces sent to repress them. There is nothing weak about paralyzing an economic system or immobilizing and causing to fall apart a political system, or inducing disaffection in an army, as the Chinese people bravely did, perhaps for the first time in human history, caused a whole army to stop, which was invading the capital of their country, and turn around and go back.
So under this rubric of revolutionary nonviolence, there's a whole playbook of 198 tactics to undermine the legitimacy of the regime. You go and you get beaten up before the cameras to show the regime no longer has legitimacy. You involve more and more people because it's nonviolent, so more people can, in theory, get involved than if it was a violent struggle where it biases it towards men. They do training in nonviolent skills, and we'll get to like the effect on the American movement first. I mean, next. But several of the elements of Sharpism include the contradiction is not class, okay? The contradiction is violence,
mm-hmm,
and nonviolence. It's states and
which is the stupidest fucking premise in the world.
It's dictatorship versus
so
something
fucking
called
childish
democracy.
It's such a liberal view of the world, a bourgeois liberal, exactly what Marx talks about, early Marx, like this bourgeois reification of the world as located in this private individual circulating freely as a commodity, as an object of the market, and subject to the rules of some kind of agreement or like whatever, social contract with the state.
And Smith also puts it in a Cold War context where because there's this danger of nuclear war with the Soviet Union at any point, and because there's McCarthyism,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so you can't be a communist,
right,
in the,
right,
U.S., the result is that to make an assault against these communist regimes the U.S. is very interested in nonviolent organization and nonviolent movements that are not going to escalate into war. But they're still trying to overthrow the regimes. They're trying to take away their ability to do both good things and bad things, destroy the whole.
And can I ask you sort of a question, and I guess, yeah, sort of comment on the kind of taxonomy that he has, sort of the authoritarian, non-authoritarian taxonomy? Because I think that's very interesting, because again, you know, this is such an abstract way of thinking about these things, because think if I tell you, like, a state is authoritarian, it's authoritarian against, you know, for whom and against whom. Like, think of, for example, people don't think of the U.S. as an authoritarian state. For example, a black kid in some, like, heavily policed inner city area. For you, like, the U.S. is an authoritarian state.
Of course.
Every time the cop, you know, like, walks by, by or something, you just, like, you could tell you, okay, like, you stand there for whatever, you know, 3 hours or something, just to humiliate you, maybe physically beat you. So it's always the question of, okay, where in the state is sort of authority being used when the threat of violence is being invoked, and against whose interest and for whose interest?
Does the U.S. have concentration camps?
Yes.
Does the U.S. have prison camps?
Yes.
Yeah.
Slave labor? Yes.
Does the U.S. have slave labor?
Yes.
So it's incredible, you know, when people talk about this stuff. And
are there millions of people in these
cleaning
concentration
highways?
Camps?
Yeah.
Fighting fires.
Yeah. California, yeah. It's
like, this goes to the pathologies, the political sort of imagination, the pathologies that suppress all reality in the face of, oh, there's a 24-hour Ralph's. Like, oh, I can tell Trump to fuck off. Like, these, like, that's, like, as if that is the beginning and end point of political subjectivity. Like, it betrays, and then on top of that, the U.S. is also the source of the world's most nasty, the world's most advanced revolutionaries in some instances. So in the case of all those regime change operations that we'll probably get to in this conversation, those people are revolutionaries, and the U.S. supports them.
Yeah,
so on the one hand, the U.S. fights its own revolutionaries with the most violent political, legal, juridical police force that's ever been enacted. Like, if you do anything against the state and you're caught, in this country, you are going to jail for decades, and maybe you can get 5 years off if you rat on all your friends. And they will hammer you, and they will destroy your family's finances, your finances, your name, like, anyone. They will, they're so authoritarian, they go and fish idiots out and get people to offer things, and, like, this happens all the time.
Are there political assassinations in the
United States?
Yes,
of course there are.
The Black Panthers, you know, let's go through a list, you know, we could go through
Who knows how many people they kill? I remember there's some neocon critic, some general who was critical of the neocons. He died of a heart attack.
Yeah.
Gee, I wonder.
Yeah.
Like,
Ferguson,
like, it's,
the
it's
guys
really
get,
not
yeah,
possible.
Yeah,
it's really not possible, like, that the U.S. and that this is the liberal viewpoint, that, no, I am a civilized subject. I'm a subject, a modern subject of a civilized liberal state, enshrined in the legal fictions of all blah, blah. It's just this stupid religion.
You know, and it's funny.
It's
that
a bourgeois
point,
religion.
The funny point about this liberal approach is it's almost like there is this idea that there is an interiority that's not expressed in your actions. So you could have a history of, like, murdering people for 150 years, but you're not a murderer.
But it's what you
are
in your
down.
Heart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's this essence that never expresses itself in action. It's just, it's hidden somewhere. Like, what the hell, you know? If this is your history, if I lie to you every day, Sina, then I'm a liar.
One of Sharpe's proteges is George Lakey. And George Lakey brings this system.
Wait, can we just stop for a second? George, can we just make this point about Sharpe?
Yeah.
This guy was working in direct
overlap. Sort of the Harvard CIA, the Center for International Affairs.
Yeah.
The Center for International Affairs.
Yes,
he
was working directly with the American deep state.
Yeah.
Like, the methods that we use to talk about revolution in our country and in others, that the idea that you can have transformational change in the state apparatuses, or plural of them, whatever you want to call them, that can take some sort of radical form, like, and the symbols that we recognize to this day, like the raised fist and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that has its own weird history too, right? Because it was appropriated from the Panthers, or I don't even know. There's probably a deeper story.
Probably older than that.
But like, that image, though, the image of radicalism, it's a performance.
Yeah.
It's a performance, right? Like, and this is something that's, and all of this has to say is that it's about representation of political chaos and the narration of that in a wider context. So,
The unrest began here exactly 3 weeks ago. Dara, the genesis of Syria's turmoil, is still at its very heart. These amateur pictures are set to show the clashes between demonstrators and the police right after Friday prayers. Al Jazeera cannot independently verify the video, but it shows thousands of people gathering in protest. With our blood, with our souls, we defend you, martyrs, they chant. Security forces reportedly fired tear gas and live ammunition to disperse the crowds, resulting in casualties. But state television showed these pictures, blaming vandals for opening fire and wounding the police and residents. These scenes are being repeated throughout Syria. From Jable and Latakia to Harasta and Banias, the people are all calling for change.
It started as a peaceful protest in one of Europe's busiest capitals. Today, it exploded into massive violence and bloodshed, now on the brink of a civil war. At least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising. At issue, should Ukraine have closer ties to the U.S. and Europe, or Putin's Russia? Our team is on the ground and under fire in this fast-developing and breaking news story. Here's ABC's Alex Marquardt.
For weeks, this European capital has been the scene of a violent uprising. Today, the bloodiest day yet, with more than 70 dead and counting.
We are not terrorists, we are free people that want to live in a free, in a good country without corruption, with good laws, with good standards of living.
Ukraine, once a nuclear power that was part of the Soviet Union, is divided and at a crossroads.
Snipers!
Caught between its past and the future, pitting East against West. Its president is accused of corruption and human rights abuses and is trying to turn the country closer to Vladimir Putin's Russia.
If Putin will defeat us, Europe will get a lot of problems because something like USSR will arise again.
Across the country, workers went on strike, adding their voices to the swelling protest movement. Thousands upon thousands willing to risk their jobs, calling for President Alexander Lukashenko to go. He tried to play matters down. 20 people decided to speak their mind, just abandoned their work and left. Their boss said, "Fine, go on. I have enough other people who will take your wages." These striking workers from a Minsk tractor factory were unimpressed. Their placard reads, "We are not 20, we are 16,000. In the early hours of Friday, authorities released thousands of people who'd been detained during the crackdown on demonstrations. Many emerged from custody with injuries and tales of police brutality. Their stories seem to have further energized the people on the street. "We are against violence. We are for peace and transparent and fair elections. We want new authorities."
Understanding that in any instance, how many examples could we set at the top of our head? Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Like how obvious right. Is it to say what happened in Ukraine was this color revolution that the U.S. has more or less admitted to them. Right. I mean, that's the thing. Like with all these fucking deep state operations or whatever, like it's not even like wear the tinfoil hat. They admit to this stuff. Yeah. They're happy to.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the empire, this is all in pursuit of the empire. And fundamentally, most Americans either don't care or approve of their empire's actions because they implicitly understand, and this is what they realize, this is one of the few things they actually understand about politics, that the comforts of their lives are built directly upon the exploitation of the outside of the global south
by
and
the
above
way,
the other
in
way.
Sharpe's ideology, exploitation is not violence.
Okay.
So capitalism is not violence.
Yeah.
It's
obviously bullshit. It's
you're
a bullshit.
Taking all the profit and paying someone peanuts, that's not violence, right? Mm-hmm. Campaigning right. Nonviolently to lower the minimum wage
right.
is not violence.
Right.
And so on. So yeah, so the color, so everybody heard about the color revolutions. And a lot of, I think, conspiracy people are like, this is George Soros behind it. But George Soros may be funding these kinds of operations, but the thinking, the playbook is not conspiratorial. It's called I think it's called, I don't remember what it's called, Playbook of...
Strategy for a Living Revolution.
Strategy for a Living Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a book, and it's translated.
Yeah, you can just read it. Just read it.
He tells you what they're doing.
And that's the thing, is that all of this is to say that the things that we are recognized and represented to us as revolutions fit this mold, and the ones that don't trouble us and need to be turned back.
Right. So Hong Kong, the Arab Spring... Even the Tiananmen Square movement had Gene Sharp, fingerprints on it in 1989.
Ukraine, Libya,
Georgia,
Egypt. Like, they were getting that money too, right? When they found out against Mubarak, their own ally.
Right.
They were feeding the enemies of their own ally this training, this cookie cutter training.
Yeah.
They had something like phones. They had their own satellite. Something about satellite phones.
Yeah, I think
same thing in Syria.
Yeah.
Like it's a playbook. It's an obvious playbook, and there's literally an author to it. And they published it.
Right. Yeah. So it's not even a conspiratorial thing.
Yeah.
It's not a conspiratorial thing. I mean, the other thing. I just want to go back to Justin's point about whether exploitation is violent or not. And I think it's not even that we have to say that exploitation is violent, but. Why is exploitation a thing which sort of might lead to massive violence or presupposes massive violence, not important for somebody like Gene Sharp, right?
Presupposes it, and it's like you were saying, the threat of violence is what underlines the whole thing. Like, if you try, you want to find out if you live in a nonviolent society, try to organize a union at your workplace. And tell your boss, hey boss, we're a union now and we demand a raise. See what happens. Right. So tell your boss we're now taking over decision making in terms of investment. See what happens to you. See how that works for you.
Any
institution you're in, it depends on the threat of violence.
Yeah, and I think the point about action is really important because you could have a society that's authoritarian that allows some kind of freedom of expression, but doesn't allow you to organize freely, because that's really the significant threat.
Yeah, scream all you want about it, nothing will change.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm.
If that doesn't summarize American life, that they can't even get basic health care.
Yeah.
They can't even get, decent, the country that crows about human rights all around the world, that has a whole class of people, a diverse Benetton ad class of people, professionals who themselves identify as human rights professionals.
Right.
I mean, come on. That's this. They come from this country and they're a product of a culture that doesn't even feed its own citizens properly.
They're failures.
It's a failed state and it's designed to be a failed state. Yeah. So
Do they have
a right to protect?
Do they have gun rights? Do they have gun rights in America? Mm-hmm. Do black people have gun rights in America? Or do you get shot if you have a gun when you're a black person?
I mean, that's...
Did that guy not get shot for having a gun by a police officer? Philando Castile, you remember that one?
It's also absurd and insulting that as if the violence of everyday life, the class, racialized, gendered, across these multiple axes of power and privilege and how society values certain lives and disowns others, figuratively and literally, all of these, the fact that we can't even articulate them. And instead we have these asinine conversations about other countries and then deem them to be good or bad.
Yeah, okay.
And then meanwhile, our own state apparatus are supporting the most violent revolutionary forces that ever existed, reactionaries that would never succeed by any liberal test, like all the U.S. academics who promoted the proxy war on Syria as some kind of liberation, as if they would even be in the same room as some FSA people, as if they would even approach them.
Yeah. But Saudi Arabia is changing slowly.
Oh, yeah, Saudi Arabia.
They allow women to try. But listen, George Lakey is the protege of Gene Sharp that brings nonviolent revolution to America in a big way. And through various movements, there's a great letter in this Marcy Smith article by a guy who left the nonviolence movement. And he kind of became a Marxist, and he explained why he doesn't buy this Gene Sharpism anymore. So Lakey's ideology which gets into the ruckus society, which gets into Central America solidarity, gets into the Battle of Seattle, the anti-globalization movement. It's full of nonviolence. It's full of imposing your will on other people is violence. Hierarchy is violence. So you construct your movement out of affinity groups, and decision-making is done by consensus. There's no hierarchy, there's no leadership, there's diversity of tactics, and they do these trainings, nonviolence trainings. It's always nonviolence training and skills, and they're everywhere. And I think, you know, a lot of where this, and then there's an academic component. There's academics who wrote this quantitative study called Why Civil Resistance Works, the Strategic Logic of Nonviolence. So they classified all these movements, hundreds of movements
stupid
across
fucking
the world, and they rated them as a one if they succeeded.
Who believes this
and
shit?
And a zero, Sina, if they didn't succeed.
She's like,
the Iranian Revolution.
Ivy League people do this stuff.
The Iranian
Revolution. Underpaid graduate students.
No, but like the professors who get credit for this stuff are probably Ivy League.
Right? Garrick at Chenoweth, let's see where she works. But that's coded as a one if you succeed. It's coded as a zero if you don't succeed. And it turns out that you're twice as likely to succeed if you're nonviolent than if you are violent.
Amazing.
You guys, twice as likely. So if you're a revolutionary.
Harvard Kennedy School.
There you go.
Wow. What am I noticing?
For the win.
Wow. That's just the wackiest coincidence.
These are the numbers, Tina. The numbers don't lie. So he brings it home. There was a debate that I watched just before, you know, during the anti-globalization movement between Ward Churchill and George Lake.
Okay.
Violence, nonviolence, right? And unfortunately, Churchill didn't do a great job. He presented it in the book, Pacifism as Pathology. I didn't think he did that great of a job, but he... You know, he said some of the stuff we're saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Lakey also didn't do that great of a job, but he was trying to say, you know, if you have a violent strategy, I'd like to hear it. And he laid out his nonviolent strategy for revolution. So it was kind of like a vacuum thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like because anti-communism clears out anything that mm-hmm. smacks of, you know, Leninism,
mm-hmm.
build a party, build unions,
right.
Organize the people, arm the people, take over, make change, right? That's what
yeah,
the different
yeah,
communist
yeah,
parties
yeah.
do. So that's not allowed. That's not, you can't
yeah,
even talk
yeah,
about
yeah,
that
yeah, yeah.
because of McCarthyism. So now there's this vacuum, and then here comes Sharp and Lakey with revolutionary nonviolence. Affinity groups, freedom, overthrow the
right.
state, attack its legitimacy, overthrow it and keep overthrowing it until something good happens.
Right? Yeah, it's like a game of chance, you know, until like you get a good hand. That
yeah. But ultimately, here's the thing. Ultimately, I think, because I read Why Civil Resistance Works, and I looked at the data. They published their
mm-hmm.
data set, and I tried to do some analysis of their data. And it's interesting how you code it, right?
Yeah.
How you code it, because I think the First Intifada in Palestine was coded as a success.
What are they fucking talking about? American academics are so stupid.
Yeah.
They have baby brains. They're all Rugrats characters.
A nonviolent.
This is terrible.
Nonviolent success.
Who thinks this stuff is real? What rubes? This is professional wrestling. She's smashing a chair over somebody's head. But that chair is made out of sugar
it's
cane. Okay?
Yeah, it's
so stupid.
Actually. But ultimately,
I hate this shit. I'm going to the bathroom.
Here's where I'm going,
Tina. I'm so angry.
Where I'm going is that I think that the Palestinians are the ultimate target of this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the whole thing...
Oh, the U.S. is the ultimate target.
No, I don't think so. I think the whole thing is leading to why can't Palestinians be nonviolent? And it's, if you think about it, Finkelstein wrote a book about this too, right? Finkelstein wrote a book called What Gandhi Says.
Shut up!
He read...
I didn't know that.
Stupid-ass fucking thing to write! Go to hell!
He read thousands of pages of Gandhi's writings, and he wrote a book about what Gandhi actually says. So he creates these tables about what Gandhi says, and he was like, I studied Gandhi because I wanted to know about the efficacy of nonviolence for the Palestinian movement.
Oh.
And during 2021, Finkelstein was in an interview, I think, on the Katie Halper show. Does she have a show?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. She has a show, and he was like, you know, I'm really sad in a way about this because I think it's going to discredit nonviolence.
Shut up!
Yeah.
Where are those people, you know? Like, you know?
See, that you're just a saboteur at this
point. I hate these people! They're so stupid!
But no, seriously, though. I mean, I just pulled it up on my phone because I wanted to get the dates right. So if you look at, like, you know, those the non-violent, you know, marches in Gaza, right?
Yeah,
so that started like,
yeah.
So March 2018. And so, like, what did those people do in, like, Palestinians who were being shot down and being nothing?
Nothing.
Right?
They're collecting checks as professionals of nonviolence.
Yeah, here's the thing, you know, at the performative level, they remember that nonviolence is actually important to them when Palestinians fire back rockets.
When they do violence.
Right? But no, otherwise, they're sort of like, they have this amnesia. They're like, oh, I don't know, violence, nonviolence, I have no idea. You know, it's pathetic, honestly. It's not even a serious project. So,
that's exactly what Finkelstein said. He said, look, people, you know, Hamas people have said, you know, we tried nonviolence in 2018. And I just think it's a shame because now they're going to think that violence...
And they would be right to think that. That's what sort of like any rational human being faced with these circumstances,
yeah,
you'd arrive at that conclusion. It's not some like crazy fanatical thing. It's like, okay, tried this.
You know,
this
or maybe it's like violence works in Gaza and nonviolence works in Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's possible.
You know,
it's
maybe
possible.
Mobs of nonviolent people... protecting houses from raging settlers.
You think the Israelis would care?
No, but just saying hypothetically, under some circumstances, it could help, you know?
There are times
when... But it's such like an irrelevant thing for us to even think about.
Yeah, I know.
You know, because we're so... Because our location of our critique in this conversation is always extraterritorial, right? Like, it's always like, oh, this is what it's like from outside, based in the most violent society ever to have existed, that sits atop a mountain of indigenous people's skulls and bones.
Like
every day that we're digging up their children that we eradicated in schools, and then we're lecturing, and then we have the audacity to sell this this bullshit in Xinjiang about the wheat, like as if like the fundamental, profound, like blood-stained legacy of the Enlightenment, the supposed European Enlightenment, as if it is ever something that could ever be even discussed as nonviolent, as if the French Revolution was some nonviolent thing. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
The guillotine memes that still circulate? Like politics is violence and revolutionary violence is part of any political struggle. If it was a real struggle to overturn something important enough that somebody would fight back, like... If something was so easy to overthrow that you could just bring out a bunch of corny ass placards and perform for the camera so you can get 30 seconds of airtime in the Buffalo fucking NBC affiliate, like
this is about
how we consume the world.
Even those, right? Like those voting rights, right? And women's rights to vote. Like those all come in the West after the Soviet Union.
The Soviet Union,
the last time I checked, was not a nonviolent revolution that created the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And they certainly didn't defend it in the Civil War afterwards through nonviolence.
Right. The thing is, it's funny because, you know, if you look at historically when Israel has made concessions, it's always sort of in the aftermath of a war where you inflicted, like, you know, material damage on them. Or you made them think, okay, actually, we could get, like, screwed over here. That's it. There's no other, like... path to success with Israel.
Oh, so Palestinians are protesting, we're going to stop being Zionists.
Yeah. We're so sorry.
Oh, have you heard this? They don't like it.
Yeah,
they don't like it when we take
them.
Like, oh, wow.
Yeah,
like,
they have kids.
It's just a baby brain.
But revolutionary...
Wait, but you have a personal angle. Excuse me. You've been avoiding all of this.
Revolutionary nonviolence does not say we move their conscience. Almost nobody thinks we move their conscience.
Okay, that's good.
Right?
That's good. Humanity has made progress.
They attack the regime's legitimacy.
This is a technique which can, at times, change hearts and minds. And when that happens, that is beautiful and powerful and lasting. But it also is a technique which can alter social and political reality to force negotiations, to force a settlement, to coerce the opponent, and even to disintegrate dictatorships. There has been more done by nonviolent struggle to liberate people from communist dictatorships and other kinds of dictatorships than anything the Pentagon has done with all of its billions and billions of dollars for 40 years.
And they attacked
in front of whom? You know what I mean? Like, moral legitimacy. To what audience?
Well, Orwell's another one, right? Orwell talks about why Gandhi worked on the British because the British have a free press, whatever.
Fuck that
shit. And Gandhi wouldn't have worked on the Nazis because they, you know, were more authoritarian. So
blah blah blah.
Right.
Justin, what's the personal angle?
Yeah,
the personal angle is that my entire life has been
non-violent.
I've been non-violent since my teenagehood. Like, I read Gandhi before I read anything else. I went from Gandhi to Chomsky.
Did you see the movie?
If you read Chomsky's, yes, I saw the movie. If you read Chomsky's book, American Power and the New Mandarins, in like 1970, that's like one of his first books.
Yeah, I've never done that.
The first chapter of the first book is called The Revolutionary Pacifism of A.J. Musty, who's like some other Trotskyist from the previous generation who was a revolutionary pacifist. So Chomsky was into that. You know, Chomsky wasn't like denouncing the Vietnamese resistance the way Hannah Arendt was, for example. But Hannah Arendt,
another liberal hero who turns out to be actually an imperialist reactionary.
She's all over the place. She's nonviolent for black people and Vietnamese, but she's all for violence, you know, against the Nazis, which is fine. That's correct.
She was half right.
Well, tells her like what's the human life she finds valuable
enough
to defend on principle and not.
Exactly.
Tell us about what dedication turned
out. From
reading Chomsky, I get involved in the anti-globalization movement, right? And I went to Chiapas.
World Social Forum.
I went to World Social Forum. But in Chiapas, that's another interesting situation because the Zapatistas are not nonviolence on principle. But there are Indian indigenous communities that are. So they're Christian pacifist communities that are affiliated with the Zapatistas. They share their goals, but they don't do violence. Mm-hmm. But then at various points when they were militarily attacked, the Zapatistas counterattacked or promised to fight, so they're kind of protecting the the violent are protecting the nonviolent.
Another movement that got commodified and turned into niche radicalist decoration bookshelves. I'm talking about how they were consumed.
In 1994, they were their
cause célèbre.
I'm saying their manifesto was we're going to march to Mexico and overthrow the government. They were, that was their plan. It didn't succeed. They made the most out of it.
I mean, think about the previous decade too was marked by these contra movements.
Yeah.
Those were protest movements. This is a tactic we've seen deployed again and again and again, whereby there's a certain dirty business of overturning governments that does most of the dirty work and the heavy lifting. And then there's this industry of flunkies who market it and launder it as revolutionary praxis. So that's how you get three articles written about a meme in the early days of the Syria stuff.
But there's also
the something, what is it? The ridiculously handsome Syrian rebel.
So I've gone to nonviolence trainings. You know, when I was in the protests in Quebec City in April 2001, so before September 2001, right? There were nonviolence trainings by people who came up from the U.S. Blake trained types. Then what's my next nonviolence? ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, that was doing nonviolence in solidarity with Palestinians. Lots of nonviolence. Occupy was nonviolence too, right? I was already kind of aged out. I didn't do very much with Occupy in 2010, but I did go, I visited Occupy a few times. All those things, the consensus process, it's criticized by Marcy Smith in her article too.
I'm going to link to it in the show notes.
The insistence on consensus actually makes it very difficult to get anything done, right?
Yeah.
It gives everybody a veto, including people who want to sabotage your thing.
Right.
And so there's all kinds of underhanded things, I suppose, that people do to make sure that, they don't get consensus blocked. But if you're not sophisticated enough to do that, then...
why is it that it's been over a century since the American left has had any kind of mass revolutionary force?
Right.
Anything close to that, right? Yeah, it's been over a century.
Isn't that McCarthyism?
McCarthyism is before, that's after. That's 50s, and that's a different class of people. But before that, we're talking about straight-up class warfare that took the form of the U.S. shooting down protesters around the country. There are numerous massacres. you know, papered over by liberal historians as, oh, whoopsie-doodles. Yeah. It's all the contradictions of the capitalists say, no, this is class warfare. This is why you need Marx in your life as, like, a basic corrective to all the stuff that, like, liberalism throws at you.
You don't count what black movements of the 60s?
No, they do, but those weren't mass. Those were not mass.
But they were
those
mass.
No, they were national struggles, but, like, you're really telling me that the Black Panthers had a mass revolutionary base? No.
But the Panthers,
they were mass in their own communities, sure, but not to say, which is not to diminish them anything, but we're talking, those are localized, or not localized.
I think that was as
the closest that you'll ever get was one part of, one sector of the population that Kel Surprise has been historically shat upon. So of course, that's gonna give rise to a militant faction that understands that, hey, we're not gonna get anywhere by asking nicely. We have to protect ourselves. And, like, look what happened to them. The one, like, actual militancy that gets stamped out violently. And, like, that's the bare vestige of any kind of actual threat to American power that actually existed. What, the Earth Liberation people in the 90s? Come on.
But that's
who
all
are you fooling?
That's all Gene Sharp said.
But that's what I mean. Like, that there was never the U.S., the corporate, or, like, the elite, or the capitalist class, however you want to describe the U.S. power structure, has not faced a serious threat to its rule for over a century.
But
that's why they focus on their imperial adventures,
and they
orchestrate these dumbass culture wars as a kind of sideshow for everyone to think they're so empowered and liberally and subjugated. Like,
but
come
if
on,
you
like,
do, if you do want, if you are radical and you do want to get involved in, you know, serious.
Yeah.
Activism.
It's a whole bunch of ops that you get to choose
from.
You will find
Gene Sharpest methods,
like,
tactics, trainings, etc.
Like, why has the left gotten nothing done in that long? Like, why has the left gotten nothing done? Why does every major radical movement, these little blips, always end up in this dumpster fire of failure?
Can we say something, like, briefly about, like, the global effects of that? Because I think one of the global effects is it's basically hollowed out all of these historical, like, radical parties in various parts in the global south and turned them into, like, you know, activists who go attend workshops. You see that, like, in every, like, communist party in every country in the world, people, like, become, oh, okay, now I'm working for this NGO. So it has this very pernicious effect globally.
It's a class. It's a class.
Yeah.
They manufacture a class of people who have an inordinate amount of discursive power to set a kind of media agenda.
Yeah, it's like a managerial class for politics, basically. Political activism, right?
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, you work in a bank or something, you work for, like, some human rights.
You're an activist. You're an organizer.
Never trust anyone who has human rights in their professional biography.
Yeah, I think that's sage advice.
Is that a good way to end this episode?
Amen.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you,
Professor
guys.
Is in the house.
Thank you for your confession. Your repentance is going, you know, it's going
sorry,
well.
I yelled and I swore to everyone. Sorry.
No, it's all right.
I'm apologizing to my sister. Sorry, Samira. I'm going to keep that in. Okay, bye. Wait, I'm still recording. Bye.